Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today, a conversation with a man who has spent the better part of a lifetime putting words to work. He's Joe Finnegan, former executive vice president and senior partner at St. Louis-based Fleischman Hillard, a leading public relations firm that has represented corporate clients around the world. Many of them, like Anheuser-Busch, McDonnell Douglas, and Enterprise Rent-A-Car, are headquartered right here. Finnegan has written a book about his experiences, and he does not hold back. It's titled Feisty. Joe and I talked about the book in a recent interview, and I allowed as to how I always look forward to hearing Irishmen tell stories, and these stories of his have been percolating for a while.
Actually, I had fooled around with what I thought was going to be a novel a few years ago, and what I ended up with was a 83,000-word abomination. And then last year I got sick. I was diagnosed with throat cancer, which is why I no longer sound like James Earl Jones. And I thought I had all this time on my hands. I couldn't do a darn thing. So I went back, I looked at the manuscript, and I said, you know, somewhere in here is the makings of a memoir. And so I set down to convert it into what is now Feisty, the book. And of course, it was published in late March of this year.
You know, you've been around for long enough to really have acquired a lot of those stories, met a lot of people, and done a lot of things. Does anything really jump out at you as you think back? Was there one thing you said, this is a story that's got to be in this book?
Probably. Well, there are three instances of what I call guerrilla PR, and probably the Löwenbräu situation when Miller acquired the rights to import Löwenbräu into this country. But after about 2 years of the original stuff from Germany, they switched the formula and started brewing it domestically. And the public didn't know that. And so I got the attorneys on it. We filed an FTC complaint, knowing that the FTC would never act on it, false advertising, but that the publicity that we could generate would be tremendous if we did it right, and we did it right. And within about a year after the filing of the complaint, you couldn't find Löwenbräu anywhere.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the stories. I think we have to back up a little bit and explain to folks that what you were doing at the time, you were, of course, with many years, 3.5 decades with Fleischman Hillard, and that you were doing an awful lot of work with Anheuser-Busch at that time. And that, I guess, is what sensitized you to anything going on in the beer industry.
Yeah, I was the lead person for our agency on the Anheuser-Busch business for close to 11 years, from 1974 through pretty much 1985. And it was great. It was a career unto itself.
What stories you tell out of that? To me, that was the most interesting part of the book, although it is only part of the book. But let's talk a little bit about some of the personalities there. Most people know of Gussie, and they know about August 3, and have been reading most recently about August 4.
Oh, boy.
I don't know if you want to go there, but that's certainly a part of the story. One of the things you write in the book was, and I have it right here in my notes, Gussie was not as big a baseball fan as most people thought he was.
What Gussie, August A. Bush Jr., liked about owning a baseball team was the halo of civic admiration and the marketing benefits that went with it for his products, far more than the baseball itself. But he also liked, and Al Fleischman, who was one of the founders of my firm, would get Mr. Bush to, for example, put on a Cardinal jersey and go down and have his picture taken with the players back in the day when spring training was in St. Petersburg, and because he had a place down there, and it was real easy for him to do that. So there was that, but he was more into the whole idea. And, of course, he saved the team by a lot of accounts. But when back in the 1950s, when he had a chance to buy the team and the stadium for, I think it was $3.5 million, the thing is worth $1 billion today, the franchise probably. But at any rate, he saw an opportunity to be a white knight, and he took it.
He certainly seemed to enjoy himself on opening day when he came through that wagon gate with the Clydesdales.
More of the civic halo, though. I mean, he was a great promoter, both a self-promoter and a promoter of his products, And he had a great flair for that.
Yeah. And beer was his life, after all. I mean, that was his life.
Absolutely. And he was a great pioneer. I mean, he was the first brewery executive who believed in the late 40s that you could do branch breweries. And so he opened Newark, New Jersey. That was the first branch in 1949, I think it was, over the protests of a lot of the purists that in his own organization. But he got Newark open, and then that went pretty well. And then after that, they opened L.A., and, of course, then they went on to have, a dozen breweries around the country now.
I have to tell you, I remember the opening of the Newark Brewery. I grew up in the adjacent community, East Orange.
Oh, sure.
And that was a big deal when Anheuser-Busch came to town.
I'm sure it was. Yeah.
Well, let's talk now a little bit. Gussie, rest in peace, and thank God that he kept the team here. What about August 3? Now, you are not totally charitable to August 3. He was a tough hombre and tough for you to deal with.
He was. He was my boss for the vast majority of the time that I served the company. And I really enjoyed working for him, for the most part. I did until I didn't. We got crosswise over Forbes magazine did a hatchet job coming out of the strike in 1976. They did a hatchet job on his dad. And so August decreed that we'll have nothing more to do with Forbes magazine. And I tried to talk him out of that because they publish every week whether you want to cooperate or not. But, you know, he made up his mind. And a number of years later, a reporter for Forbes called me out of the blue, said he was doing a story on brewing. And I said, I was very straightforward with the guy. I said, I can't talk to you. I can't put you in touch with any AB people, but I can send you some existing materials that were put together that talk about how we brew beer and that sort of thing. And I made the mistake of calling August's office to tell him what I did. And that was the last bit of work that I did for Anheuser-Busch. So he was tough.
No nonsense, and very steely, I gather. Not much of a sense of humor. Just, again, all business.
He was very much into the business. He knew the business cold. You know, he started out as a hourly worker. His father insisted on it. He'd get a union card and, you know, go down in the bowels of the plant and learn how to brew, not only make the beer, but package it and get it out of the plant. And then he went on from there to climb the ladder, so to speak.
Well, let's talk about that climb, because as we indicated a moment ago, there was a kind of a palace coup. He basically elbowed the old man out.
In 1974, and his father's feathers were ruffled and his feelings were hurt, and they did not talk. They were not civil with each other for several years after that. It wasn't until August the 3rd decided it was time to make a bid for Busch Stadium, which the company did not. This is Busch II. The company did not own that stadium. It was owned by a public-private partnership called Civic Center. And the economics of the game had changed because of free agency. And Anheuser-Busch, in order to get that stadium built, was willing to give up the concession revenue and parking and those sorts of things. And now the economics of the game had changed. So he decided to go after he asked Charlie Doherty, who was heading Civic Center at the time, if they could amend their agreement. And Doherty said no. So August said, well, in that case, you'll be looking at an unfriendly takeover bid. And so he went about the business of trying to cobble together enough shares of stock in Civic Center, and he fell just short until he was able to go to his dad, I guess on bended knee. I wasn't there, and he convinced his dad to call in some favors from some of his cronies, and they got enough to purchase the stadium and the surrounding developments for, I think it was around $52 or $53 million. It was a good investment.
Sure was. When you think about what the value is today, how well did they get along after that?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. He called his dad. He always called his dad Chief, mm-hmm. And I think I think things settled down after that. I think there was at least an uneasy peace, if not a real one. And, of course, Mr. Bush Jr., Gussie, was getting way up in years. And by then, August had complete control of what was going on at the company.
Was he at that time, and I know we're talking, you left in the mid-80s, was there any discussion or any evidence at that time of grooming August IV for what he eventually became?
Not that I was aware of. Yeah. The IV was still very, very young at that point. I guess he might have been, I forget how, he's 51 or 2 now, I think. And I did not work directly with him. He was younger than that. He really hadn't begun his ascension. He was starting college at about that point in time. So I'm not sure.
Starting college, and college is where he first came to the public's attention, I think, with that accident in which a young woman was killed.
Very unfortunate.
What do you make of the most recent episode involving him with landing a helicopter, apparently?
It's just sad. Yeah. I don't know what else to say.
You know, somebody said the other day that this tends to happen in families of means, you know, that the more the generations move along, something gets lost with each passing generation. You agree?
That's a broad generalization. I don't know that I do agree. You know, if you read the other books that have been done, Dethroning the King and Bitter Brew, and I know both of those authors well, you have to, at least from a charitable standpoint, you have to conclude that the IV was probably capable and deserved a shot, but that his dad was certainly trying to control things along the way and got in the way a number of times. I don't know how much of that is true and how much of that isn't, because I was not in the picture at that point.
You know, it was, of course, during his time that the brewery was sold.
Yes.
Yeah. Your thoughts about that, having been associated with it for so long?
Well, it was a perfect storm. The U.S. economy was the way it was at the time. We're talking about coming out of the Great Recession in 07, 08. The brewery had a series of pretty dismal business failures. They tried to get into soft drinks. They tried to get into steamship line. They tried to get into snack foods and a whole bunch of things that August had turned responsibility for over to three or four or five guys who probably at that point in their lives had become so wealthy and so risk averse that they weren't going to take any chances. They didn't take any chances. Those ventures failed. The international expansion of Anheuser-Busch didn't go nearly as well as the shareholders would have hoped, as Wall Street would have hoped, and they were ripe for the plucking at that point. And along came these very, very smart, savage Brazilians with a plan, and they just vacuumed them up, $52 billion.
Now we're talking some serious money. There's no question.
Now we're talking serious money.
I have to take a quick break, and I'm going to do that, Joe Feng. Before I do that, I noted, and I mentioned this to you before we went on the air, that you were very careful in cases where you were critical of people not to mention their names. That was obviously a conscious effort on your part, not to mention the names of people you were critical of.
Guilty as charged.
Let's take that break. Joe Finnegan is our guest. He is the author of Feisty, which tells the story of his many, many years in the public relations business. He was one of the main characters at Fleischmann Hillard, a class operation in St. Louis, worldwide operation now. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we resume our conversation with Joe Finnegan, longtime public relations man here in St. Louis. He's the author of a memoir titled Feisty, which tells his story going back over those many years, many interesting people he's met, places he's been, and things that he has done. Joe, you said just before we took that break, guilty as charged, when I talk about your not mentioning names. Well, how comfortable are you telling stories about people that you've worked with. Any discomfort level at all in that?
Well, generally speaking, not really. But there are some people who it's probably wiser on my part and more charitable for sure not to drag their names through the mud, lo, these many years later.
Yeah.
So why do it?
When you say dragging through the mud, there must be many stories then in which that's exactly what could have happened if you chose to tell the story.
Well, if you're focusing on Anheuser-Busch, it's the ventures that didn't go well and the people who were responsible under Bush III and him too for those ventures. And, I watched these guys get very rich and very fat and very risk averse. And I think that's one of the reasons why his faith in them was not borne out, was not warranted. And I think about that, and I think how tragic that is, because the takeover could have been avoided had a few things worked out differently. For example, they had a non-voting, roughly 50% interest in Corona down in Mexico. If they had simply been able to proceed with the total acquisition of that, there would have been too much Anheuser-Busch for InBev to swallow. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the public relations business, which is where you spent all of your time, even though you were the designated hitter at Anheuser-Busch for a period of time. You say at the beginning of the book that it's important to differentiate between public relations and advertising. Differentiate that for me right now so people understand that there is a difference.
Well, there's a big difference. And, basically what we did was all communications other than advertising. So that begs the question, what's advertising? Well, advertising is paid for time in the broadcast media or in social media, I guess you could say now, space in the print media, newspapers and magazines and so forth. And what we did was by and large not paid for. What we did was we wrote a lot of stuff. We issued press releases. We served as liaison between the working press and the clients. In this case, most of those clients were corporations, not all. And we would write speeches. We would do financial news releases. We would do when opportunities arose that we would help defend our clients from problem situations that might arise. Advertising doesn't get into any of that. And so the two disciplines, although it's become a little bit muddied over the recent years, the two disciplines are quite different in that respect. Now, what's happened in recent years, though, because so many PR firms have been acquired by ad agencies or ad agency holding companies, that those lines have been blurred somewhat.
Would it be fair to say that in any sense that public relations at times is used to manipulate the media?
I don't like that term.
I didn't think you would, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, I don't see it as manipulation. We had a reputation at our shop anyway for being very, very straight up with the media when we had to deal with the media. And I think most of the reporters around would verify that, would vouch for that. So I don't know if it's manipulation. I think it's an honest attempt on our part to represent the best interests of our clients.
There is one segment concerning a reporter whom I will not name, in which you talked about getting him to run a particular story that would be advantageous. That sounds to me like kind of giving the story a little shove.
Is that a question?
Yeah.
I don't know, Don. I'm not even sure I would classify him as a reporter. He was more of a gossip columnist than anything else. And of course, his ability to obtain gossip depended greatly on the cooperation of all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life. Along the way, the truth sometimes became obscured.
Yeah. How did Fleischman Hillard become the giant that it became? I mean, it started relatively modestly.
In my opinion, it started when Al Fleischman and Bob Hillard didn't have kids. Neither one of them. They were both married. And yet neither one of them had offspring. And along came John Graham, who was my boss, who's still chairman of the firm. And along came yours truly and several other young men and women who were, in effect, the next generation and who were, in effect, Fleischman and Hillard's kids. And they felt well enough about us, I guess you could say, as we approached the mid-70s, to hand us the keys to the car. They retired. They stepped back. And Graham, who was a man of great vision and a great many other skills, and I, primarily, started the movement to grow the firm. We opened John opened a Kansas City office in 1977. That was followed soon thereafter by offices in New York and L.A., and then we took off from there.
Right. And in terms of dollar growth, I mean, what is it? It was sold a few years back. What was the price tag on that?
That's never been disclosed. I can tell you that the firm that I joined in 1972, one office, 24 people. When we were sold in 97, there were 50 offices and billings of around $150 million. Today, billings are $500 million, and there are 80 offices and roughly 2,700 employees around the world.
Well, that's quite a growth in a relatively short period of time.
Right.
Testimony to people like yourself who made that happen. I'd like to get in now to before talking about your father, and I definitely want to get into that part of the story. It's the most touching part of the book. A little bit about some of the accounts you were servicing following Anheuser-Busch. There were numerous accounts, all very, very well known. Give us some sense of what your life was like at this time in putting the brewery behind you, for instance, and moving on to McDonnell Douglas and cigarette companies and all the other big corporations that are out there.
I have to admit, losing Anheuser-Busch was a tremendous – it hurt. It was a tremendous blow to my ego. But I always figured that if anything ever did happen, and I had friends who would ask me, what are you going to do if it goes away? And it did. Mm-hmm. And I always figured that if I was a partner in the firm, if partnership really meant what I thought partnership should mean, then there'd be other opportunities to, because I had an ownership position in the firm. There'd be other opportunities. And you know, the phone started ringing. And, you know, Ralston Purina was the first company, and we had done a lot of work for them, or a fair amount of work for them. Hillard had on the corporate side, but we'd never gotten into the marketing side of the business, which is really where the budgets were. Mm-hmm. And along came Ralston Purina, and guess what? A budget. And we took one of their programs and made it very successful promotionally, and made quite a bit of money as a result. And I thought, you know, hey, this thing has legs, maybe. So went on from there to do a lot of work for Honda Motors, Enterprise Rent-A-Car.
Valvoline.
Valvoline Oil Company, yes, and a host of other companies. And so life was different at that point. It was from an ego standpoint, it wasn't nearly as fulfilling as the Anheuser-Busch work. But I think, you know, if I really had to be honest about it, after about 11 years with Anheuser-Busch, and John Graham told me this at the time, and I kind of blew it off, but he was right, that I was ready for a change.
Well, and there was plenty of change ahead, obviously, as all documented in the book. You mentioned Enterprise, because it's a local company, we should mention that too. And what a remarkable story that was. An easy story for someone like yourself to tell.
Yes and no. Initially, it was funny. Jack Taylor, the founder, was a very perfect gentleman, very low-key, wasn't sure about any of this promotional stuff. But his son Andy, who took the reins, of course, after Jack, understood the value of it, and they were on they were right on the doorstep of taking over as the number one rent-a-car company in America, if not the world, I forget, based on the number of cars in their fleet. The problem was, and I told he said we want to play that up. And the problem was, and I told him this, that we need a third party to vouch for it, and because of the nature of that business, we couldn't. There weren't a lot of third parties floating around, but we did find a fellow who published a newsletter out of San Diego that covered that industry. And we weren't sure about his math. So we brought him into St. Louis, taught him how to count, sent him back to San Diego, and lo and behold, he published a story about Enterprise becoming number one in the industry. And we were able to take that information then and turn it into pieces in the Wall Street Journal and the Time magazine and other publications where it really counted.
And off it went. I mean, it was off over there. Not bad for an outfit that basically started in a garage, I guess.
Yes.
Very, very humble beginnings.
Lindbergh Cadillac, the basement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about Dad for a moment, because as I mentioned, this is the most touching part of your book, I think. You never knew your dad.
I did not.
And it took you better part of a lifetime to catch up with him.
46 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was killed in the hedgerows in Normandy about a month after D-Day. I was born 6 weeks to the day after he was killed. And the way I coped with it for years and years and years was I tried to act like he never existed in the first place, and not knowing how much it really hurt. Finally, in 1988, I think it was, a friend of mine, Randall Foskey from Williamsburg, Virginia, who's a history buff, he called me on the phone. I was in my office, and he said he had just come back from Normandy, a visit over there, and he and his wife were walking through the American cemetery, 9,300 graves. He looked down, and there was my dad's grave. And Randall said, "Have you ever visited?" And I said, "No." He said, "Have you ever seen a picture of your dad's grave?" I said, "No." "Would you like to?" I said, "Yes, I'd love to." He sent me a picture, photograph, and my life changed. Just that instant when I opened that envelope and pulled that picture out. And with it, of course, was a message from him, from Randall, saying, "You got to get over there." And in 1991, October 91, my first wife and I made the pilgrimage. In the meantime, I had become obsessed with him. He was a St. Louis boy, St. Louis U High, class of 1934. Married my mom, whom he met when she spent one semester here at Fontbonne before she went to Northwestern and became a journalist. She got her degree from Medill. At any rate, I spent all those years trying to avoid dealing with his memory, and then all of a sudden it became an obsession. So I made that trip, and then Connie and I, my current wife, were there in October of 2002. And yesterday, my oldest son, Matt, and his family from Denver, Colorado, visited my dad's grave for the first time. And I cannot begin to tell you what that means to me.
What did it mean to you when your first visit and you found that grave? What was your emotion like at that time?
I cried for 2 hours. Yeah. I hugged the cemetery is the one that people are familiar with because it was used in the opening and closing scenes of Saving Private Ryan. In fact, the night before, we came across the English Channel on a boat, and it took all night. And I was pacing all night. It was almost as if this guy is going to be alive and he's going to greet us when we get there to the cemetery. First of all, I made amends to him. For all those years of indifference, if you want to call it that. And it gave me an opportunity to do that. But I was an emotional wreck. The superintendent of the cemetery, he had a live one on his hands with me because he was very invested in his work. And when he found out that, number one, I was the one and only son of this guy, and number two, I'd never been there before, he rolled out the carpet. And he took us out to the gravesite, and then he gave me afterwards all kinds of information about where my dad's unit was and where they were fighting. He was only in combat for 4 days.
That's all it takes under the conditions like that.
That's right. And it's plotty, mm-hmm. Row 26, grave 23. That's his address. I'll be back. And we're going to be back next year.
Good for you. One or two other things I wanted to talk about, Joe, is the as our time begins to wind down. A lot of pressure in the business you were in. You were a drinker. And you drank for a long time. And finally got past that. How did you do that?
Sick. It's an old and tired cliche, but I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I was in my mid-40s. I was very aware that I was an alcoholic, and I was very aware that if I didn't do something about it, that the next step was going to be I would lose everything, you know, probably. And so I sought help and got it. And that was in September. September, of, I went to a treatment center here in town in late August of 1990, and started attending regular meetings in September 10th of 90, and I've been sober ever since.
How are you able to function effectively during that time?
There's a term that I've heard around the tables of Alcoholics Anonymous about people who claimed, and I believe this because I think I was one, I was a functional alcoholic. That doesn't mean that my game was getting sharper, quite the opposite. I could tell that it was cutting into my ability to function and to do a good job for my firm and my clients. And that's one of the, by the time I got there, no one had to convince me that I had a problem. You know, a lot of men and women go kicking and screaming into recovery. I did not. I was ready.
Yeah. And some of your colleagues knew that there was a problem. I think, if I remember correctly, you mentioned to John Graham, your boss, that you were going to be dealing with this. And he was very supportive, but he had known that you were dealing with this.
Oh, he knew.
Yeah, he knew.
He knew. He sensed it. We had a couple of talks about it, and he said, you better do something about it. And I said, yes, sir. And a couple of months later, I finally did. I mean, it took me a little while. Sure. I dragged my feet a little bit.
I only bring this up because you deal with it extensively in the book.
I welcome it.
Yeah. And I think people need to hear your story and stories like it. And Joe, we wish you the very best in dealing with that, needless to say. Also the very best with the book. It's a very, very enjoyable read. Anybody from St. Louis really should read it if they want to know about some very important history. Congratulations.
If they go on the website, www.feistymemoir.com, or go on Amazon or any number of booksellers around here, they'll find it.
Now, was that an advertisement or was it a public relations comment?
Yes.
Yes. Joe Finnegan, thank you.
Thank you, Don.
And that was Joe Finnegan, longtime public relations guru with Fleischman Hillard. His book is Feisty. That's next on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.